I want to welcome you all to CSIS. Today's talk is being organized by our Homeland Security Program. We have a sheet of paper outside explaining a little bit of what we do, including introducing ourselves, which I did not do yet. I'm Gerald Epstein. I'm in the Homeland Security Program here. And we've also got a paper with a description of some of our recent publications. If you have, CSIS has just done a revision of its website. It's now much more user-friendly, much more sophisticated, and all of your old links will probably no longer work. So if you've got a reference to a CSIS report or a bookmark, you may have to do that again. We have tried to make sure we have the current URLs in the material we've given you. And if you have any problems, please let me know about that. Today is one part of our science and security series. One function of that series in the past has been to bring folks doing research with security implications to the attention of the Washington community, where we have a number of people more familiar with the policy and the security side than the science. If you were here last January for Drew Endy's talk on synthetic biology, that was in that mode. Today is quite a different application. Our speaker today is very well immersed in the science, the security, and the policy applications. Maureen McCarthy, our speaker, a PhD in chemical physics. She worked for several years at the Battelle Pacific Northwest Laboratory, came over to the policy and security community as the first fellow of the American Association of the Advancement of Science Defense Policy Fellowship, and spent that fellowship at the Office of Secretary of Defense. Maureen went from there to the Department of Energy, where she was there at the creation of the National Nuclear Security Administration, became its chief scientist, and in that capacity served on the Transition Planning Office, which was inventing the Department of Homeland Security. So Maureen had you all, of course, know about the Homeland Security Department having been created from 22 or 23 other existing agencies, which in whole or in part were taken over to DHS. There were a few things in the DHS that did not exist elsewhere in the government, and those may have been the most important reasons to have had the department, one of which was the Science and Technology Directorate, which Maureen and her colleagues on the Transition Planning Office helped to design. And then for her sins, she got to implement them, and now serving as the director of the Office of Research and Development in DHS with a purview over the R&D funding that the department spends in an extensive array of government laboratories and also supervises activities in industry. So we can't have a speaker more qualified to talk about issues at the intersection of science, technology, and security than Maureen today. And we very much appreciate her willingness to talk on what she's going to be addressing. This is not the title that I had in my announcement, so let's go by what she says she's talking about rather than what I said. One of the things that's most characteristic, as I see it, about the biological threat is I know a few other areas with such a great gulf between what's been demonstrated and proven decades ago, with technology continuing to advance in many relevant areas on the one hand, so the capability side, versus the relative paucity of actual attacks we've seen in the past on the historical side. Given this wide gulf between what we've seen and what we think could be, there's plenty of room to argue for almost any position in between. And I think looking out among the crowd, I think those of you are all arguing every position in between. And so how the government is to navigate in this realm between what we haven't seen much of to date and, oh my God, the sky's falling, is of critical importance to our National Biodefense Program. As I understand it, and I'm here to learn as you, the rest of you, I believe that Maureen's talk is going to talk about how we decide what we as a nation have to pay attention to. So I want to thank our speaker. I do want to point out that we're recording today's talk and we will be posting it on our website, so when you get around to asking questions, keep that in the back of your mind. And we'll be going until both the speaker and the room have a hard close at 3 p.m. So I think we could probably keep ourselves occupied until then, but let me welcome Maureen McCarthy.
Well, it's a treat to be here. I must admit, this is it's an excellent opportunity to actually be able to address this talk to this audience. I did take your title, Gary. I understand there was quite a bit of interest in the National Biological Analysis and Countermeasures Center, and so my title actually reflects the fact that I'm going to put that center in the context of the biodefense mission that DHS has. Before I start, though, I'd like to introduce a few of the key people that are with me from my staff. Dr. Bernie Courtney, who is the research director for the NBAC, has joined us today. Dr. Carol Linden, most of you may know from the policy and bio community throughout the years, and Carol is my senior scientist. C. Cindy Christian is with us. She's the head of our outreach. And Jerry Limer, who is my communications person here. And Tom Burke is with us from our public affairs office. So we have quite a few people here. I tend to talk very openly. The slides are representative of some thoughts. I encourage you, I want this to be a dialogue, and I encourage you to ask questions. If you have questions, we'll try. I would like to be able to run through them, put this in context, and catch the questions at the end. But if there are things that I'm talking about in the course of my discussion you need clarification on in the middle, please feel free to raise your hand, and we will address them as we go along.
I'm sorry I didn't get you a roving mic, but I'm not sure what the pickup of that is for our webcast.
Okay, I rove. You can't get me to stand still, Jerry. First, I want to be able to introduce you from the top as to what the biodefense mission responsibility is for the Department of Homeland Security. And I think Jerry gave a very good short synopsis of the fact that when the department was formed, as he mentioned, there were 22 agencies or count the number of agencies that came together when the department was formed. The Science and Technology Director was formed from scratch. And one of the very important elements of the Science and Technology Director was the fact that it actually was taking on a lot of the advocacy roles for the protection of the country against weapons of mass destruction. So what I want to do for you now is to put the context of what we do in biodefense in the context of the rest of the department's missions. Show you how things are tied together at the departmental level, and hopefully that might clarify why we're in certain parts of this business. First of all, from the department level, you've heard our vision statement of what our responsibility is. And when I describe the department, and I think this is an important thing in terms of culture, you have to understand who the Department of Homeland Security is, what our culture is. Now, many of you are very familiar with other government agencies. You know what it means to work in defense. We had a mantra when I worked in the Defense Department, protect the warfighter, understood what that meant. Many of you may also come from the public health community where your focus is very much on public health. It's important for you to realize who the Department of Homeland Security is and who we are not. Fundamentally, at our heart and soul, we're a law enforcement agency. That's not a big surprise. Okay? Most of what the department does, most of the operations we do day in and day out, are associated with law enforcement. Customs and Immigration and Trade Enforcement, Secret Service Protection of the President, things that are involved in operational, which have a lot to do with our law enforcement. And we sometimes describe that as security enforcement because it's really in the prevention end of law enforcement rather than the prosecution end. But when we work closely with the first responder community, we work most closely with the first responder community that's involved in law enforcement. So that's important. Is really what I call protecting the nation. This is the prevention end. This is what we do in order to ensure that we put countermeasures out there. You want me to talk to the mic?
Then we can go on the lab.
Okay. We put countermeasures out to not only protect ourselves against specific threats, but also to be able to enhance the operations of the department. The third area is what we call building national resiliency. Okay, now you've heard a lot of discussion recently about response and recovery and things like that. I want you to think about response and recovery, particularly when it comes to the science and technology missions of the department, in terms of what we do in advance of an event. Building resiliency is what we do before something happens to ensure that once we have to respond or enhance recovery, we're able to do it. So this tells you that the focus of the department and the culture of the department is trying to get ahead of what might be happening. Okay? We're not in the prosecution business. We're actually in the prevention business. Okay. So One of the things that's been critically important that's happened in the department, and the secretary has been very forward-leaning on this, is the fact that we are now moving into a part of the department where we manage by risk. Okay? And that's important to think about. There's a difference between managing by risk and managing by consequences. Risk is the ability for us to integrate threat, vulnerability, and consequences into our decision making. A lot of what we have to do in the department is to be able to do quantitative, systematic risk assessments so we understand what problems we have to target and why. And we understand what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. That's the hard part of the decision making. That's the part of the department that has gotten to the maturity after 2.5 years of being in existence. We are now at the maturity portion that we can actually make risk-based decision making for what we need to do. That's a key part of what we do throughout our missions, and it's a very key part of what we do in biodefense. Okay, so what is the single biggest challenge that we have, and particularly us as scientists who work in this area? What's our challenge and what are we working with? And what do we deal with day to day, here and now, and what do we have to worry about into the future? Okay, the biggest challenge the department has is the fact that day in and day out, we have huge amounts of operations that go on in the department. Okay, we have security, enforcement, and response operations that are going on continuously. Okay, all of you are well aware and day to day have contact with DHS's types of missions. Everything from visas and immigration, every time you cross through an airport, customs and trade, all the activities that go on throughout the department in those areas. We obviously have a lot of work in prevention and protection. Secret Service is protecting the president. We're doing exercises to ensure the continuity of the government. We do work on critical infrastructure. There's all sorts of activities that go on day in and day out that are involved in prevention and protection activities in the department. Investigation and prosecution is a part of the department. We are looking at cyber crimes. We're looking at currency fraud. We're looking at drug trafficking. All of those things are going on. And then obviously response and recovery. As you can clearly imagine, the amount of time we've spent on things like responding to Katrina and all the hurricanes that we've been dealing with there, planning and being involved in the preparations with our colleagues from HHS on the pandemic flu. Lots of activities are going on. So this is what the department does day in and day out. Okay, $40 billion, 180,000 people, most of them are on the front lines conducting an operation day in and day out. What's our challenge, and particularly our challenge in science and technology, is to be able to take those operations and put them under a shield of protection and prevention against the worst threats that we imagine. Okay, and that's chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear. Okay, so when you think about DHS, okay, think about the fact that there's a baseline of operations that goes on day in and day out. Okay, our challenge is to get into the mindset, into the operational entities in the department that are doing all those activities, from rebuilding New Orleans to protecting the president to processing you through airports to bringing immigrants in this country. We have to get into the operations and instill the shield that will protect the country against the worst possible threats that we're worried about from a terrorist perspective. Okay, bio is a big portion of this. The biodefense strategy of the department is key into this. But when you think about it, remember we have to do our biodefense in an operational environment that already exists, that has huge challenges day in and day out, which means that our challenge, really, and particularly those of us in the technical community, is to make all of those operations more effective and more efficient and more secure. It's introducing security into ongoing operations to really enhance the ability to protect the country. So, let me go back to the threats a little bit. Let's talk about how we describe and how we understand and how we prioritize what we do. And I'll focus this specifically, this whole talk is just on our biodefense missions. Obviously, we have a lot of other activities that we do. When we look at biodefense, we look at risks. Okay, and this is a pictorial cartoon of how we think about risk. This is a two-dimensional picture of risk. So let me describe this a little bit, talk to you a little bit about what the philosophy of risk assessment is and a little bit of what risk management is. Okay, so you have two axes here. One axis says the complexity to execute an event. How difficult is it for an adversary to actually do something? Okay, that's the y-axis. The x-axis is really impact. And impact is a combination of vulnerabilities and consequences. This is a pictorial representation, remember. Okay, but most of all, what we're concerned about is national scale impact. Okay, when we look at these, for the most part, if you wonder what keeps us up at night, for the most part, it's things that occur in what we call the upper right-hand corner. Okay, why? Because things that could have a huge impact are generally really hard to do. And that's good news for us. Things that are really difficult to do and have a major impact are the things that could affect the country on a national scale. It's not that we're not interested or not concerned about things that could have a localized impact. But if you want to know where our highest priority will be, it'll be the things that we're most concerned about, things that could be hard, have a massive impact and are generally hard to do. Okay? Now, what does that tell you about other things on this category? Well, you can see down here that we have foot and mouth disease. Down here in the really worried about category, which is something that could have a big impact, but is relatively easy to do. Now, those are, now, that impact is not loss of human life. An impact in our world is a combination of loss of human life, major national scale disruption of the economy, loss of societal confidence in the government. Each one of those is hard, gets harder and harder to quantify. Foot and mouth disease probably isn't going to kill any people, has the potential to have massive economic impact onto this country. So when we try and decide what are the highest priority things that we do, that's risk assessment. That's the snapshot. Integrating into this what we know about the threat space, integrating what we know about terrorist and adversary capabilities, integrating into this picture what we know about vulnerabilities that we may have and potential consequences. The difference between risk assessment, though, and risk management is basically looking at the things that we're worried about and trying to figure out how to make them less impactful. And there are two things that you can do, right? Basically, you can make the impacts less, okay? So that may be investing in areas where you deploy countermeasures, you deploy vaccines, you have a robust set of countermeasures that can respond to an event. Or you can make it harder for the adversary to actually do it, okay? You try deterrence, you try a lot of different activities. So when we look at what we're working on, we not only look at what are the most catastrophic problems, but we go after problems that we think we can actually shift substantially on this. And obviously the ideal state is to take everything over to the left-hand side, okay? Our goal is to make things minimal impact and really hard to do. Okay, so that's just a cartoon picture of what we have to think about. When we look at risk assessment in the bio world, this is a tough problem because each one of those problems, it's a dynamic problem. You'll get a snapshot in time about what we know about the vulnerabilities and consequences across this spectrum. And as we improve our countermeasures, as we improve our intelligence information, as we improve what we're able to understand about impacts, those things shift. And we have to be dynamic and responsive and able to respond to the evolving information that comes out of doing risk assessment and risk management. Okay, so pictorial representation at the highest level of the department about what our philosophy is. What drives our biodefense programs? Okay, we don't drive it internally just from the department understanding of what has to be done. Actually, in the bio world, we have the advantage of having a national biodefense strategy codified in the president's biodefense for the 21st century, outlined with four pillars to biodefense.
These are the pillars that the government as a whole, all of the agencies who play in biodefense, work underneath this umbrella. Threat awareness, prevention and protection, surveillance and detection, protection and prevention, surveillance and detection, response and recovery. The four pillars of the biodefense strategy for the government. Each of the agencies in the government works and has different responsibilities. You'll be hearing a fair amount from us about some of our primary responsibilities, which are both in the threat assessment world and also in the surveillance and detection. That's where the forensics and attribution missions fall. Obviously, we as a department work across all four of these pillars. Some of our programs we're lead on, other programs we're support in. The advantage that we have in biodefense is that the biodefense community has grown up over the last 5 years. You know, it was something that obviously after the anthrax letters became a pronounced and major issue for the government to pursue. The government agencies have been working out and now have this national scale umbrella, national strategy umbrella to work under. We are clarifying our mission responsibilities and working very synergistically across the spectrum. I'll be focusing in on a few key areas for which DHS does have the lead that are associated with the NBAC programs. So, I know there's been a lot of interest in discussing NBAC and who we are and what we are. The description of what NBAC is and does, I'll keep very high level and allow you to ask some more questions afterwards. National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasure Center is the critical element internal to DHS that houses a lot of our biodefense, not all, but a substantial amount of our biodefense activities. The purpose of the NBAC is basically twofold. It is to provide the nation, as you can see, the mission statement, to provide the nation with the scientific basis for awareness of the biological threats and to attribute their use. Okay, so our big issues in NBAC are twofold. It's understanding what the threats are, and it's providing the technical basis to do forensics and attribution. We do that through three different types of activities, two of which are primarily located with the NBAC facility up at Fort Detrick, which is the Bioforensics Analysis and Countermeasures Center and our threat characterization work. I'm also going to describe to you a program that we have, which is actually biothreat knowledge integration. The reason that's important is because it ties a lot of all the things that we do together. And it's actually an existing center that we support, which is actually at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. So that's what NBAC is, okay? That's what we do. So when you think about DHS, remember, go back to the first slide I said. We're fundamentally a security enforcement agency, okay? We are not in the business of developing medical countermeasures. That's the responsibility of Health and Human Services and the programs through there. We are in the business of prioritizing the threats and driving the prioritization for that countermeasure development in partnership with our colleagues from HHS. So think, keep in your mind why it is that we are associated so closely with both the threat awareness mission and also the forensics. Let me explain one of the gems in the government. And I think it's important to put this in context because I think it tells you the level of cooperation that's happening in biodefense, which I think is unique in the government. The National Biological Analysis and Countermeasure Center is an element of what we call the National Interagency Biodefense Campus at Fort Detrick. Okay, now that may sound like a whole lot of acronyms, okay? But let me explain what the magic is. And there is magic in this government occasionally. The five agencies in the government decided to come together and actually build a campus to enhance the development of the intellectual capability necessary for this nation to pursue the biodefense responsibilities it has. Fort Detrick exists, and most of you know, and many of you are very familiar with USAMRIID. So at its heart and soul, USAMRIID was there, and they have been in the medical countermeasures and the medical threat and the biodefense business for troop protection for years. Okay, so you're well aware of their capabilities. In addition to USAMRIID, though, we had the advantage of bringing all of us decided that that leveraging that capability and partnering with DOD was critical for us to come in as each of the other agencies stood up with biodefense responsibilities. So HHS decided to house one of its key elements and new facilities there and to build upon that campus responsibility. So that's through NIAID, and that's where the Advanced Imaging Diagnostic Study Center will be. In addition to HHS, we have the U.S. Department of Agriculture, whose foreign plant and weed activities are there. CDC has joined us. So the five of us form this campus. Now, why is this so important? It's important because it's one of the first times in government five agencies have come together and made a commitment not only to sharing, to understanding and cooperating with our different mission responsibilities, sharing basic resources. We're sharing the critical infrastructure elements on the campus. But most importantly, and probably the hardest thing for us, is we're sharing the intellectual capital. Okay? This is a hard business. Being in the biodefense business is hard. The public health community has been in the biological sciences world for a long time. But merging the biological sciences world with a national security culture and a defense culture is unique. And so the fact that we, as five different agencies, made the commitment to work together and to share that intellectual capital is incredibly important. And it is interagency magic. It's a part where actually we've seen phenomenal leveraging of the different agencies with each other. We actually manage this through a board of directors, you know, and I sit on the board of directors for DHS, and we meet regularly. Actually, we're meeting this week. So when you think about who we are in DHS, DHS does business differently. We live and breathe on the partnerships that we have with other agencies. And that National Interagency Biodefense Campus is exemplary of that. As you look at what NBAC does, okay, as I told you, it does, you know, basically two major activities. It does forensics and analysis and attribution. And there, this is a unique capability. Obviously, many of you, all of you are familiar with what we went through with the anthrax letters in 2001. Okay, at the time that that happened, this nation didn't have dedicated bioforensics capabilities. Dedicated. Trained people, qualified labs, certified labs, places where you could do the analysis, where you weren't doing research, where you had full chain of custody, where the FBI was able to take samples, and you could run through casework. Dedicated facilities didn't exist. They now exist. We've stood up an interim facility while our new facility, while our new building is being constructed. And its job was to develop, to a large extent, the bioforensics technical community. Okay, bioforensics really wasn't a technical discipline. So we had to invest a lot in microbial forensics, and to develop that, we had to develop training programs in order to accredit that and be able to conduct casework. Obviously, we had to go through all the processes of developing, testing, and validating assays that we use. And probably one of the more challenging things is establishing reference collections. What are we worried about globally? Who has what? How do we know what the reference basis is? And the basis for forensics investigations are very often different and complementary to, but different from, the same basis for reference collections for public health. And then obviously we have to conduct forensics casework. We conduct forensics casework continuously, and we have been operating and taking casework samples from when this facility first opened in May of 2004. And we are working very hard to not only do the casework that we take in from particularly our colleagues at the FBI, but also to push the intellectual community to establish bioforensics as a research area. In addition to the forensics work, which is really a large extent is involved in understanding threats, we also have what we call a biological threat characterization activities. Here, this is where we do the laboratory work to actually close the gaps in our knowledge about specific threats. Okay? And one of the big activities that this center does and these programs do right now is conduct systematic and rigorous threat assessment risk assessments that will guide the prioritization of the countermeasure development for the rest of the government. That is a major activity of what we're doing, and many of you in this room have been very engaged in that risk assessment work. In the risk assessment, one of the things that comes out of risk assessment is identifying gaps in our knowledge, things we did not understand. And when we do that, we have the ability to conduct certain laboratory experiments in order to close those gaps. And in particular, we work very closely with our other colleagues in the other agencies to understand how to prioritize the investments all of the agencies are making. Okay. We tie all that together in what we call a bio-knowledge center, or a biodefense knowledge center. And I highlight this only because one of the big issues that we have in our community, and I told you we're a very operationally focused, mission-driven agency. We have a responsibility to produce information that is operationally usable, or what we call actionable information. We take a lot of the activities that we do and we provide that information throughout the government, and in particular throughout our agency, in different forms that can be used by people who need them. So for instance, we have what we call tactical response reachback. That's a 24/7 line. Okay, you can pick up the phone 24/7, ask a very specific question about a specific area. Maybe gathering what do you know about pandemic flu? What do you know about this type of activity? 24/7, we turn those requests around in a couple hours, anywhere from 20 minutes to a couple hours. We also provide very proactive, what we call proactive awareness bulletins. Those are things that we generate that are informing specific operations, whether it's immigrations, worried about a particular area or group of people or type of activity, or, you know, transportation, what concerns do you have about certain flights or different types of modes of transportation. Those things are sent out to the operators to inform their long-term planning for their operations. And then we do what we call strategic assessments, and some of those you're probably quite familiar with. We do what we call the material threat assessments, which are the part of the program in biodefense that actually drives the prioritization for the acquisition programs for BioShield that HHS conducts. So we tie everything that we do in the knowledge generation into these specific tasks, and we allow that information to be actionable and usable by the operational community that needs it. Okay, so I'm just going to highlight, and this is words, okay? You can ask me questions about the specifics. I want to highlight some of the activities that NBEC has accomplished over the last 2.5 years since we stood up. Okay, first and foremost is the fact that we are actually doing evidence evaluation and casework for the bioforensics. That's a major activity. Okay, it involves, as I highlighted to you, a lot of work, handling a lot of casework, predominantly for the lead law enforcement agency, the FBI. We have conducted numerous material threat assessments that drive the acquisition of countermeasures through the BioShield program, and we're partnered directly with Health and Human Services in that activity. We are in the process of completing the first of our annual end-to-end biorisk assessments. And that came directly out of the biodefense strategy, the national strategy. Our deliverable is to produce that for the White House in January of 2006. We're working with our interagency colleagues on that right now. We examined in detail the top 29 agents from the CDC list and went through a systematic, rigorous, and scientific process for understanding the risks. We've also, as I highlighted, the fact that we provide technical reach back on all sorts of biodefense issues 24/7 to the department. And probably important to this audience in particular is the fact that we've also implemented rigorous review processes that allow us to look at all of our programs for compliance and adherence to rules, laws, regulations, and policies in the government. Okay, that's part of what we have to do. That is an essential element of executing our programs. Because I know this was a topic of interest here, let me highlight for you a little bit of what that means. Okay, when you're in the biodefense business, you have a lot of things you have to look at. Okay, we have to look at everything from environmental policies and laws. We went through a NEPA process to establish the building of our new facility at Fort Detrick. We also have to review our programs for scientific merit, all the policy, all the legal constructs. Institutions that we support have to go through institutional review boards. Those of you in the biological science community recognize this. This is all standard. Select agent, toxin security, all those things, rules, laws, regulations that came out of the Patriot Act and others after 2011. Animal care and use. Okay, all of these activities are things that we have to deal with. And in particular, and probably of interest to a lot of people here, is we also implemented a very rigorous process to assess all of our programs for compliance with the Biological Weapons Convention. Our biodefense projects are reviewed against the criteria of Article 1 of the Biological Weapons Convention. I know this is an interest to this audience. This is the process that we do. And Carol Linden, who's here from my staff, has this as her responsibility. So she is responsible for developing the processes that we go through and actually doing the rigorous reviews. So the bullets that are up here are familiar to all of you who have read Article 1 of the treaty. You know this is a hard thing to do because the Biological Weapons Convention, or the treaty itself, is intent-based. It doesn't have a lot of rules and regulations. It doesn't tell us specifically what you can and can't do. It's based on intent. And so that's what we have to go through in order to assess what we do for these. And reviewing each of our programs and each of the projects throughout the department for compliance. Our starting point for leveraging the compliance evaluation and for evaluating our projects really comes from the Fink report, the establishment of the NSABB in HHS, where all programs have to look at 7 criteria. I think I have only 6 on here, but there are 7 criteria. We start and we leverage off of that. Okay, those are the things that we examine all of our projects for. And we do this in advance, and we assess the project's compliance in accordance with this and other things that we think are important to address. How does the process work inside of the department? Okay, this is just a pictorial flow chart. We start with our program development. All the programs in the department are looked at and examined in their early stages when they're in program development. We conduct a compliance analysis and prepare an assessment. That's what Carol's office is full-time responsible for. So that there is a compliance assurance program office that looks across all of these programs, takes the information from the people that are working in the field, assesses it against the criteria, goes back iteratively and asks for additional information, looks and tailors and prepares an assessment of the programs. We have a compliance review group that's established internal to the department. Let me tell you, when you're working with a brand new department, when you need to do something in the department, we had to do it at the department level as well as at the S&T level. So we have established inside of DHS a rigorous compliance review group. It's chaired by the deputy secretary. It has the representatives from the technical areas, policy and legal. It looks very familiar to many of you who worked in the compliance business to the way DOD did its strategic nuclear treaty compliance issues. There, we're not only reviewing technical aspects, but you're reviewing the aspects of policy and legal and any other issues that may be relevant to these programs. That compliance review group conducts and determines whether there are any issues that either need further review or if there's specific programs they recommend taking to a full certification, which will be signed by the secretary. Okay? That's how DHS does its compliance review. Okay, we're in the beginning stages of this. All of these pieces are here, and we are running programs through this process right now. Right. That's been a major accomplishment. We've been able to do this just over the last few months to get the whole process in place, all the way up the chain from the person who's working and turning, you know, pipettes in a laboratory, all the way up to what the responsibility is the secretary in the department. Okay? And now there's a process in place in the department that covers that whole entire spectrum. Okay, so I'm only closing here because I think it's important for you to be able to ask the questions that you have. I think it's important, though, when you think about not only what we do, what the structure is. I tried to introduce you and take you down from the department's level strategy and vision, the national strategy in biodefense, all the way down to some very rigorous processes that we do for compliance. I want to tie this back together, though, with the philosophy that drives us. In the biodefense community in particular, probably more so than almost any of the other areas, we are plagued by the notion that we have to be anticipating what might happen in the future. Okay? We have to be in a position, as the secretary has clearly stated, and I can tell you he lives and breathes by this philosophy, we cannot be beguiled by the risks and events that have happened in the past. That doesn't mean to say that things that have happened in the past aren't things that we aren't dealing with. But we have to be concentrating our efforts and understanding new and emerging threats, things that may be the threat to this nation in the future, not just 6 months from now or 2 years from now, but out 5, 10, 20 years into the future. So that's a driving factor of what sets up our programs. It also tells you why we are so insistent and so deliberate about the work that we do in threat characterization and also the work that we do in forensics, because it all comes back to understanding what our anticipation is about the future. So with that, I will close. I will happily take questions on the specifics of the programs and the processes. And get a glass of water in the process.
Marina, let me take one first myself, and then we'll turn you over to the audience. You mentioned the criteria drawn from the Fink Committee report. You certainly were not saying if the answer to any of these is no, we will not do it. I'm wondering if you could say, when you ask yourself whether they fall in these categories, what's the next question you ask? What do you do with that information?
Okay. Actually, yeah, that's a very good question. No, the answer, and just like it is in the NSABB process, the answer isn't no, you can't do it. The answer, but that's the set of criteria that we ask out to the programs as things are being developed. Then we start to define and drill down on the specifics of what is going on, what are the activities. If there are activities that reach past a certain threshold, we do a review and we bring those through the compliance review process on a case-by-case basis. So there are a whole bunch of programs that you sort of take off the top that are unrelated to, you know, specific issues relating to the seven criteria. And then there are a few that we will take up on a case-by-case basis all the way through the compliance review process. And that's not just the technical portion, that's the policy and the legal.
Great, thanks. Let me open up the questions now. And let me first remind everybody here, a question is a small number of words followed by a question mark.
Can you please identify yourselves? Yeah,
for the audio versions and for all of our benefit, you can identify yourselves. Gary?
Thanks. I'm Gary Strong with MITRE. Maureen, I'd like to ask a clarification question about NBFAC. So it gets engaged when there's a criminality or a terrorist act, but that's not always known in the initial stages, and also it's not always known from biological evidence either. So who makes that decision?
Very good question. The way the BFAC is set up is it is the lead technical facility for the lead law enforcement agency. So we, as a general rule, BFAC is engaged because it is requested specifically from the lead law enforcement agency. Almost everything we take is either directly from the FBI or coordinated through the FBI. So they actually make the decision. Now, you're absolutely right, and we've been through lots of issues, including the anthrax issue recently in the mail facility back in the spring, where there was that period of time when it was determination as to whether it was a public health issue or whether it was a law enforcement issue. in that particular case, the coordination was going on back and forth between the FBI and the public health community, requesting our assistance, but they were coordinating it directly through the lead law enforcement agency.
The current AAAS fellow in the OSD. I'd like to ask for your thoughts with regard to the BARDA legislation, especially how that might impact MBAC and its execution of its research projects.
You'll have to be a little more specific. Which one is this?
The BARDA legislation, the Biological Development Agency, through
yes.
the that's being developed by Senator Burr,
yes.
put forth through the yes. HHS.
Yes, we actually have internal to the department. We have an official policy stand on that. We believe firmly that the organization of the biodefense world right now, as it's established, and the roles and responsibilities of the agencies is working. And we are supportive of the current structure that exists.
David Roop with Global Security Newswire. When you were presenting your risk assessment table, you said that the emphasis would be on threats that are high impact and difficult to do. That seems counterintuitive. Sounds like you don't really do risk assessment at all, because if you're doing high impact, that's hard to do, and presumably not ignoring high impact, that's easy to do, then you're doing high impact, regardless of whether terrorists out there might be able to do it or not.
Okay. I think I got the gist of that. What I was telling you was that at our highest priority, we certainly go after the problems that we believe can have massive disruption on a national scale. Okay? So when you do risk assessment, you incorporate threat, vulnerability, and consequence. That little picture is a two-dimensional cartoon. It's meant to capture that concept. We are most concerned and will focus a majority of efforts on things that can have massive national disruption. And so we do go after those problems. For the most part, things that can have a national scale impact are difficult to do. That is where the risk assessment is coming out. But we certainly go after those things where we're concerned about disrupting the nation as a whole, and then structure both the countermeasures work and also what we do in understanding the threats towards those problems.
Can I follow up with just there's a line of criticism that says, I'm sorry, a line of criticism that says
that the government's investing billions of dollars for defense against traditional biological threats, even though they may be unlikely to ever occur, instead of focusing on maybe some easier threats that might occur. For instance, avian influenza, which I noticed wasn't in your grid at all.
Right. When we're looking at the biological risk assessment, we are integrating the threat portion of this. And the threat portion not only takes into consideration what we understand about threats, but technical feasibility. So you're absolutely right. It's part of the reason why I stress the fact that risk assessment is not a static state. It isn't a fixed answer. The more knowledge that we understand about specific threats, both from an adversary perspective and also the understanding and leveraging what we're learning about emerging infectious diseases. Right now, there is obviously a lot of attention being paid to pandemic flu, and HHS is very engaged in that, in the context of it being an emerging infectious disease. We are learning and taking that knowledge into our risk assessments, which incorporate, you know, threat, vulnerabilities, and consequences in order to drive that prioritization. So it is not a fixed state. It's not that you develop this list and you just work on that for the next 10 years. It's an ongoing process. When I said that we're delivering the first end-to-end risk assessment, that's the first annual one. We have a responsibility to deliver this actually every 2 years in a very rigorous and systematic way. Part of what you're seeing in that risk assessment is we're identifying gaps in our knowledge where we really don't have enough information to understand where things fall on the risk curves. And when we close those gaps, things may go up or come down, and are concerned about where they fall in that space.
Keston Baum, National Public Radio. I was just a little unclear. When you talk about doing your end-to-end threat assessment, do you fold into that intelligence information about groups you know abroad? And are there groups you know who are working on biological weapons? I mean, do you say, we know this person, this group has such and such a person, they've been trying to get this? Is that sort of stuff folded in?
Yes, we do explicitly fold in intelligence information into our risk assessments. And we have a fair amount of information about different types of activities. We also look at different areas, associations with criminal activities. So we fold in all the available threat information that we can into actually doing the risk assessments. I won't go into any details on that.
Brian Finch from McKenna, Long and Aldridge. I was wondering if you could clarify how the role of science and technology is impacted by the creation of the chief medical officer.
Absolutely. I can tell you the chief medical officer is an absolutely essential element to the Department of Homeland Security, and we are delighted to have him on board. And in particular, I'm delighted to have him on board because his office is right around the corner from mine. But one of the things, you know, when I talked to you a little bit about the introduction of DHS being predominantly focused on day-to-day operations around enforcement, having somebody in the department with the credentials that Dr. Runge has and that office has to actually tie us directly to the medical community day in, day out is absolutely essential. So you can imagine what his top 10 list looks like right now. He walked in the door. The office was only stood up literally right in the middle of Katrina. So he walked in the door after Katrina had hit while we were still in the response, had a lot of responsibility for interfacing directly to the public health community, but also providing the secretary with frontline advice on medical issues. And he is now coordinating all of those activities internal to the department and able to work both out to the community and also back feed us information back. So he's a tremendous asset to the department.
David Segrist. Hi, David Segrist, Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. Dr. McCarthy, about a month ago there was an incident on the Mall, and it would appear that BioWatch signal interpretation may be more complex than one might have thought. Are there plans in place to establish a process for characterizing the signal? And what implications would that have for both the NBIS and the BWIC program?
Good question. Yes, there are, and for those of you who are unfamiliar, I'm sure you might have read about it in the paper. There was some period of time when we had some detection of something on one of the biodetection systems in the National Capital Region. The processes are in place. The protocols are in place. The coordination between the agencies is very complicated, but it works. And we exercise it a fair amount. Currently, right now, and back to the question that was just asked, our chief medical officer actually has the lead role responsibility for interfacing that community. The catch with these biodetection systems is they're deployed out into local regions. And so the coordination of a response is not only a federal government responsibility, it goes down into the state and locals, into the public health communities in the state and local areas, into lots of different jurisdictions. But we've been working exceedingly closely with our colleagues at CDC, and we do actually have protocols in place, we do have processes in place, and we are improving our ability to implement those and streamline those as we go through some of these incidents. All the detection systems will feed in directly into NBIS, so that's one stream. The National Biosurveillance Information System, Integration System. It will be a national scale system that takes information not only from the environmental detection systems, but from medical surveillance. And all of that information will be implemented and coordinated. Now, that system is being put into place now, doesn't exist as an operational entity yet, but will.
Sandy Spector with the Monterey Institute. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Sandy.
I wondered if you would comment on the decision of the United States government to reconstitute the 1918 flu virus and what the role of your agency was in that decision and whether it is now on your list in the upper right-hand corner where it might not have been before.
I'll give you the short answer. The answer is no. I'm not going to comment explicitly on that. That decision was actually a decision made by Health and Human Services, and we were engaged, but they had the lead responsibility on that. The issues to deal with pandemic flu are ones that we take very seriously. We are working very closely with HHS. We each have our task forces, and we've been looking at the response issues. For the pandemic flu, though, I will tell you that DHS has a lot of responsibilities in this area that are not to do with the actual medical countermeasures portion. Okay, so go back to the original slide and remember what our role and responsibility is. A lot of what DHS has to do when it comes to dealing with the issues of the flu has to do with borders and customs and transportation, free flow of people and immigration. What are we going to do if there are outbreaks outside of the country? How do we decide who comes in, who goes? What are we going to do for enhancing inspection at the borders from, you know, imported parrots to people potentially coming across the borders? And then how are we going to respond if there is an outbreak here, and how do we provide support, as we did, you know, in Katrina and other activities that could have overwhelmed the local medical community? So DHS's responsibility in the concern about pandemic flu is really tied to what our operational roles are day in and day out. HHS's responsibility obviously has the lead and is concentrating on what is necessary to deal with the countermeasures. And we coordinate with them, but they have the lead in that.
Bruce McDonald, and then Lisa. I'm Bruce McDonald. I'm a consultant with Arcadia Biosciences that's doing that work with Jim Burens. And Maureen, my question is sort of a little bit general, but what, in your view, are the tough nuts to crack in bioforensics? What are the tough challenges, what you want to throw attention that would make your life a lot better if those problems were solved or at least, you know, addressed in a way that made you more comfortable? What's the top one or two or three things? Is it just cost? Are there fundamental technology blocks? What keeps you up at night?
Actually, you know, the interesting thing is, I think if you had asked me that question probably a year or two ago, the answer probably would have been much more technically focused. Having assays, being able to look at specific problems we were concerned about. I think right now, our bioforensics community has developed. A lot of work has gone on in the microbial forensics to actually push the science ahead. Some of the issues that we have are much more basic than that. It's the ability to analyze evidence and do all of the forensics analysis of the evidence all at the same time. So being able to handle samples where we can do bioforensics analysis and standard forensics analysis, fingerprints, DNA, all the chemical analysis, all the other things that support the casework in an integrated fashion with people who are trained and qualified and can work in the laboratory is a big challenge. Okay, so that's one. The second thing is absolute 100% surety that we maintain the standards of handling evidence so that there is zero contamination. Now, that may not sound very cool and sexy, but let me tell you, it's hard work. It's training people, it's developing procedures in laboratories, it's making them quick and efficient and able to turn around analysis so you don't ever get yourself in the position of having cross-contamination. That is what the law enforcement community needs. They need us to be able to do it with high levels of confidence, and they need us to be able to do it quickly. And that's a challenge for us. The technical community, I think, has really stood up in the last 2 or 3 years and pushed the science to its forefront. And that's delightful to see, because we're coming up with new technical methods to do the analysis almost faster than we implement them in the laboratory, and that's a very positive thing.
University of Maryland. You went into some detail at the end of your presentation on the review process, the compliance review process within DHS for its research projects. I was wondering if you could tell us what, if any, external oversight and review process exists for research being done at the BTCC. And here I'm referring not just for oversight and review related to scientific merit, but also for dual use concerns and for treaty compliance. And then one quick additional question that I think you can answer with a yes or no. You identified engineered organisms as among the highest impact threats that we face and indicated that BTCC is going to be doing lab work, among other things. Does the BTCC have an institutional biosafety committee itself registered with NIH?
Okay, very good question. First, let me go back to the original question, which was the issue of external coordination. For the treaty compliance process, the Department of Homeland Security, like any other agency in the government, is responsible for ensuring its own compliance. That's a responsibility each of the agencies have. We recognize the issues of coordinating with the scientific community is very essential, and we have mechanisms to do that, particularly for scientific review. And I can tell you when we have our scientific reviews, they involve people who are very familiar with the NSABB process and all of those activities. We have a standing committee from the National Academy that meets every 6 months, a couple times a year, and it looks at ad hoc issues that have to do with the programs that are specifically for NBAC. We use a lot of coordination mechanisms internal to the government, interagency coordination mechanisms. Carol spends a huge amount of her time personally out dealing with the interagency community on these activities. So we do have a fair amount of engagement. Now, when we look at our reviewing our committee, or our projects, obviously, we review with people who are, you know, appropriately cleared and qualified to review our technical programs, and we have conducted scientific reviews in that regard. We also participate in the NSABB process. DHS has a seat on that, and so we've been involved directly with HHS and that organization. On the issue...
outside of the department for its projects. That's all internal. Whatever consideration of dual use risks and what has been released publicly about the work being done and anticipated, especially in the TCC, it looks to be virtually all of the people. There's no external oversight.
Okay, watch what you mean by ex. Okay, depends on what you mean. On the dual use question, okay. We work very closely with our colleagues from other agencies in the government. Okay, we do have coordination with HHS, and we do have coordination with DOD on those issues. And the dual use issue is one that obviously is one that in the biodefense community you can't not deal with. Okay, it is an issue that we take on responsibility for, and it's part of the technical reviews we do with the programs. Okay, it's explicitly asked of the projects when we develop them. We ask and we look for areas where that's an issue. And when we do technical reviews, we do bring in people who can look at those issues. So yes, we do that. We do that in coordination predominantly with our colleagues from other agencies. On the issue of the institutional review boards, IBC right now only applies to an institution. We are not, the BTCC is not an institution. That right now we're only executing programs, projects at existing institutions. Those institutions already have their established IBC.
And when you do your own lab work, you will have an IBC?
Correct.
Nope. And then I'll go over to the side of the room, we'll go to the back. Milton Leitenberg, Center for International Security Studies, University of Maryland. I'd like to try and put several things together that puzzle me. You say that you want not to work on things even 6 months ahead or 2 years ahead, but 5, 10, and 20 years ahead. That seems to me to almost by definition have to come out of an understanding of basic science. I don't see how you can be working 5, 10, and 20 years threat ahead out of validated intelligence, validated threats. So that's the first problem. The second is this seems to be very, very different. In speaking with Congressional Quarterly last year, General Parker used this phrase, if I can read it, that if there was a clear indication that we're faced with a real potential of a genetically engineered pathogen, organism, whatever, that we don't understand, we have to leave open the possibility we may need to replicate that. So that did refer to a validated, except there are very few or next to none terrorist groups actually doing that for which you have such information, which sounded to me as if it was an open invitation to replicate the Soviet BW program rather than terrorist one, which is an enormous menu. And since we say that was an offensive program, we simply would be sticking the defensive label on it because we're trying to understand it. So I have two problems. One is the not 6 months or 2 years, the 5, 10, and 20. How can that be for validated? I didn't understand Parker's thing, because it's not terrorism. That's something like the Soviet program. And then if you could also explain, at the end of your quotations that were in the chemical and engineering report, you mentioned that you work closely with the State Department and that through them, it was a little bit ambiguous, that you had had meetings with some foreign countries and explained particular NBAC projects, and that made things more understandable. That certainly, if not explicit, at least implicitly, says that people had questions. And I'm curious whether State asked you to do that, or the countries came to State and said, could you folks please explain X or Y to us?
Okay, fair questions. Let me address them as best I can from the litany that you had. First of all, I apologize if I implied that we weren't concerned about things that could happen 6 months or 18 months or 2 years from now. I said we cannot lose sight of the fact that there are problems that may be out there 5 or 10 years, and we can't not address those while we're dealing with things that we understand right now. I think your position and your point is very valid. At the further you look out, obviously, one of the drivers is what the technical community, the scientific community, generates. Now, we're not in the basic research business. Okay, DHS is explicitly not in the basic research business, particularly for biodefense. We are watching the scientific community to understand those areas as the scientific community evolves. Issues like dual use is a big issue in the open scientific community. Drivers for what we will look for, prioritization of the projects that we do, are very targeted against risks. And those risks could be generated out of the basic research community, the notion that things could become dual use that we hadn't realized before, that certain biotechnologies have more accessibility or utility globally than we had anticipated, or that we have a better understanding of a specific threat. And you're right, we use and we incorporate all of that information. That's why I stress the word risk and not the word threat. Threat is the generation of information we are concerned about, and we will tailor our project specifically to address specific issues. And they may come out of publications in the open scientific literature that raise an issue to us because of dual use. That is one of the key examples that we use. So I hope that clarifies a little bit of where we're going. Yes, we do coordinate our activities with the international community through the State Department as do all the other agencies. We have been requested to brief our programs to the international community along with our other colleagues in the biodefense community. That is sort of standard for the U.S. government being able to explain why we're in the biodefense business. And we have been engaged with them for quite a while and continue to be on a regular basis.
Jim Delaney from the Institute for Defense Analysis. I just got back from Tokyo where we did our third seminar for crisis managers from industry and local governments as well as various ministries and the self-defense forces on new threats. There's a growing appetite there for homeland security cooperation with the U.S. With your background, as Bill Schneider describes it to me, in energy, where presumably you worked with the Japanese and had some experience, is there a role for bilateral or international cooperation in the areas that you talked about today? Specifically, because Japan is targeting more of its investments in science and technology towards some of the things you're talking about.
It's a very good question. And I can tell you that our international engagement is increasing in DHS. We have had, and the secretary and the international offices have had engagement with the Japanese so far in lots of different topic areas. And you can imagine when you deal with homeland security, there are lots of areas of interest among our international colleagues. And I think we're prioritizing those. We're engaging with them. We're looking at the activities that are important for us. I think in the biosciences community, as you are well aware and everybody else in this room, it's global. Okay, there's no big question there. It's global. It's global from an industrial perspective, from a government perspective. It's a global issue, and we are all finding mechanisms to cooperate with our international partners there. And I think the engagement that we've had with the Japanese so far has been very productive, and I think we look forward to having more of that.
Thank you. Dr. Diane Berry, I wanted to ask, you've addressed today a lot about the bioterrorism risk assessment, but I would like to know how chemical and radiological threats fit into everything, and are they considered among the 29 agents that you're going to be reporting back to in January?
Very good question. And you probably highlight one of the big challenges that we have in the department. When I made this specific, I focused this talk on the bio problems, on the biodefense problems, because that's what the audience was most interested in. We have programs, obviously, that are targeted at the radiological and nuclear problems, at the chemical problems. And right now, the sophistication of the risk assessment methodologies and approaches is that we are pretty good at being able to prioritize in a given threat area. Okay, we have mechanisms, technical, scientific, and rigorous mechanisms to look at prioritizing, you know, among the bio agents or among the chem agents or among, you know, what we're concerned about in radiological and nuclear. One of the challenges that we have technically is being able to do that integrated across the threat space. And there it becomes a challenging technical question because we have tremendous variations in the amount of intelligence we have, the amount of information we have about the threats, large-scale differences in the potential impacts, and how do you quantify impacts from loss of human life to economic impacts? How do you put on the same scale a potential nuclear weapon going off in, you know, pick a city in the United States against, you know, a possible attack using a chemical weapons agent? That is the challenge that we are facing right now. Integrating across the threat space is one of the big areas in risk assessment that we in the department, we in the technical community will be working on this year. So it's not that I play down those threats. We have big programs in each of those areas, and we spend a lot of energy working with our colleagues in the other agencies internally to work on the problems and do the countermeasures, but integrating in a comprehensive fashion is one thing that I think we're just getting the sophistication to do now.
Marty? No, I'm sorry, no. My question has to do with, if you look back over the last 2 years and how you've managed to move what you have moved ahead, and you look ahead to the next 2 years, how do you think you could streamline all these decision processes, all this proliferation of groups, all of the turf battles, to be able to make decisions effectively enough to double or triple what you accomplish in the next couple of years?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, I have to tell you that the progress that we're making now, and I can, over the last 6 months, the progress that we're making has gone up exponentially. We, you know, getting ourselves organized for the first 2 years was a big challenge. One of the things that has happened, and this is one of the benefits, the silver lining, if you will, from many activities that we've had to deal with. I'll give you Katrina as an example. Okay, lots of us spent lots of time working on Katrina and Katrina Task Force. The lessons learned that we're getting out of how do we deal with the response on a national scale is absolutely critical. We're taking those lessons real time, turning them into what we're planning and dealing with in looking at things like preparations for pandemic flu. We're able to take those lessons learned much faster. I met with the secretary last week. We had a discussion about this. The first thing he said to me was, I've learned a lot from Katrina. We can actually make this work. So the difference of where we are now is we're out of the planning stage, we're into the doing stage. And in the doing stage, we're actually able to take lessons learned and apply those across the boundaries very quickly. So we've learned a whole lot about our national capability to respond to a national scale incident from something that had nothing to do with terrorism and had to do with Mother Nature. Applying that directly to our operational activities day in and day out is really what I think will make the biggest difference, where we become not just an incremental improvement for the way the government responds, but an exponential force multiplier for our ability to look at very major things that could have a major impact to the country.
Hi, Alan Pearson, Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Hi, Maureen. I used to work with Maureen. Two questions. One, going back to a question that was asked earlier about the 1918 flu, and that is 1918 flu now on the list of agents that DHS is thinking about together with anthrax and smallpox and so on? And likewise, as I'm sure you're aware, there's work either already ongoing or about to start that looks at making reassortments between the current avian influenza strains and human influenza strains for risk assessment purposes. So is DHS looking at that and trying to think ahead a little bit about where those things may fall out in the end? So are they on the list? And if not, is there currently a threat assessment process going on that you can tell us a little bit about for how that decision is going to be made? The second question goes back to the issue of compliance. And you discussed a process by which you will be doing compliance review for specific projects, but there's not, as far as I can tell, a compliance review process for the program as a whole. And that may be important in the sense that when you look at any specific project, it's quite easy to say that project X, Y, or Z is done with the intent of defensive purposes and would therefore be compliant with the BWC, accepting perhaps some things under Article 1.2 where the BWC says don't do actually delivery mechanisms. But when you take the group of projects as a whole and look at it as a program, you run the risk of perhaps inadvertently stepping over a line and recreating what could be an offensive program, even if you didn't intend to go there initially, but you end up there. So the question is there a compliance review process for the program as a whole in addition to specific projects?
Okay, good questions. First, let me take on the compliance review process. Yes, we review the programs as a whole. Compliance decisions are not done ad hoc. Okay, they're done for very specific activities. But when the compliance review reviews them, they review the totality of the programs. They understand the context of why we're doing what we're doing. Okay, specific projects, that need an in-depth assessment will be, you know, examined and taken through that process in the context of the overall mission responsibility that we have. And so it is important, you're absolutely right, it is important to understand the programs as a whole and what the context is that we're doing them and why we're doing what we're doing. So that should answer the first one. Back to the 1918 flu. When we started the biorisk assessment, we had very specific direction for how we did it. And this was, you know, this is the first time we really wanted to put scientific rigorous methodology behind doing risk assessments. And we tried three different methods we down-selected to do, and then we integrated them to one. They are rigorous risk assessment methodologies. The input for that was driven by the top 29 agents that we knew at the time. So H5N1 was not on the list initially. Not to say we're ignoring it, but it wasn't on the list of the top 29 agents. You know what the list are, so the CDC list. Are we interested in? Yes, very. Are we working with HHS? Yes. We're working with them and collaborating with them right now to understand not only what their issues are in order to enhance their ability to develop their countermeasure programs, but also even in the forensics world, we're working with USDA in understanding the collection, their ability to collect USDA and Department of Interior, their ability to collect wildfowl samples and isolates so we understand the progression of the disease overseas. So yes, we're very engaged with the agencies right now. Obviously, that's why you have to have a responsive program. But the risk assessment process that we did was driven by requirements that we got over a year ago, and that's the part that will be delivered in January.
David, is it short? Because I want to make sure.
Yeah, very short. What's your direct RITS view on whether the BWC allows for construction of biological delivery devices, weapons delivery devices, Mach 1s, that could be used to do testing for threat characterization?
Okay, first of all, it's not my directorate's position. Okay, you know the basis for which we all make decisions. Okay, the BWC is intent-based. Okay, it doesn't tell you what you can and can't do. It tells you why you do or don't do something. Okay, so fundamentally, we have to be able to assess threats. Okay, that's a given. And we have to be able to, but I can assure you, we are in the biodefense business. Okay, everything we do is by intent set up to support the biodefense programs for this country. That's the position. Outside of that, that's why I told you it's a rigorous, in-depth, technical review on a project-by-project basis.
Isn't